Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Happy Independence Day, 4th of July. I've got former D-League assistant coach and future NBA broadcaster, Lang Whitaker from NBA.com. Lang, how's it going?
What's up, man? We've been talking about doing this for a while.
Yes. Yeah, you had this idea. You were very excited about it. And I don't want to quite let people in on it, and I want to talk a little bit of shop before we before we get into it. But you are going to be calling summer league games. You just told me.
Yeah, the word is out now that I do a podcast on NBA.com with Sekou Smith and Rick Fox, and we're going to be calling some games on NBA TV during summer league in Vegas. So
that's exciting.
It's exciting and a little terrifying. Because none of us have really, well, Rick has, but Sekou and I haven't called games, and we don't have any play-by-play experience. However, what better time to learn than on live international television? So,
I feel like though that you guys are clearly, you have a good rapport, you have an excellent podcast, you'll just be talking to each other.
Yeah, I think that's what it'll be. Today. We did a podcast this morning, and Rick is in South Africa filming a movie because, you know, Rick Fox does things like that.
Of course.
And we were just doing it and talking, and all of a sudden Rick Fox calls in. So, and we talked about all sorts of craziness. So that kind of stuff happens, and hopefully that'll happen in Vegas. I've never been to Summer League in Vegas, so I'm actually looking forward to just sitting there and watching an avalanche of basketball for, you know, every day for 2 weeks or however long the thing is.
Yeah, I think I've been there. This will be my fifth time, I think.
Okay.
And this will be the second time I'm doing the entire, like, wow, 11 days or whatever it is. And, two years ago, I was going to do the entire time, and then it was like day eight, and I just said, screw it, I'm going home. And I just changed my flight and left.
Yeah.
Cause that's a long time to be in Vegas. And then last year I did the entire time, and when you get back home, it's just a different world. Like, you're back in the real world.
And
like,
what's the key to, like, you know, keeping your wits about you for that, after that much basketball for that long?
I think the key is that you don't try to pay attention to everything. There, right. Like, there's a lot of stuff where you just, like, sit back and enjoy and be a fan, and, like, you'll have to, you know, you'll have to call games or whatever, or I'll have to write articles. But I think that's the key, is like, don't treat it like it's real NBA basketball.
Right.
Just like, oh, you're at like an AAU tournament or something. That's kind of what it is.
Okay.
And don't go to casinos.
Yeah,
that's the other thing.
Yeah, I think my dad's going to be there, so that'll probably keep me in line somewhat.
Yeah,
you know, from that standpoint. but yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
That's awesome. What would you say? Who would you say is your most, like, who are you looking forward to the most in Vegas in terms of, like, rookies, people you'll be there with?
Nate Robinson. I don't even know if he's going to be there, but...
Oh, I'm sure he'll show up.
He's had his jersey retired from Summer League because he's so good at Summer League, and it's like a chance to see Picasso painting.
Sure. Know?
This is Nate Robinson's milieu, and this is what we all are, you know, lucky to see. So I hope Nate Robinson plays in Summer League. I doubt that he's playing Summer League because at this point in his career, he doesn't...
I think he's coming off, like, an ACL injury, right?
Yeah, definitely. He's probably still hurt, so...
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd like to see, I guess I'd like to see that Wiggins Parker. I think that's the first day of Summer League, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
That should be pretty fun to see. And I'm sort of curious to see how Parker's game is going to translate to the NBA level. I'm curious to see if Jason Kidd's going to be coaching the Bucks. he coached the Nets last year. So yeah, there's could be some interesting things to see out there.
My just on a personal level, my three favorite moments in my summer league experiences were, third was watching Rashad McCants get kicked out of the player section a couple years ago. Maybe it was last year or the year before. So that was fun to watch. And if you can hear hammering in the background, it's just construction going on that I can never stop, and it's always going to happen, apparently. Yeah. My second favorite moment was I got to actually vote for the Summer League Awards last year.
All right.
That was cool. And then my favorite moment was I was walking from one gym to the other gym. I walked behind the announcer table, and someone grabbed my arm, and I, like, looked, and it was Brent Berry while he was broadcasting. He said, hey, we should hang out later. So that was, like, a really cool – like, I just text all my friends, like, hey, guys, this happened.
Last year, they did a – you know, there's the one day where Orlando and Vegas overlap.
Right.
it's like the championship games in Orlando and the consolation games, and then Vegas starts. And that day, there's something like 18 straight hours on NBA TV of live basketball. So last year, they had me live blog that day for NBA.com. So I woke up, you know, whatever. The first game's at like 8 a.m., and I was just going all day long. And at some point, Rick Kamla started talking about me being tired during the broadcast. And I was so tired, I was thought I might have imagined it. And I was like, did that just happen? And I had to rewind it. And so, yeah, I think Summer League is where dreams come true, Zach.
Yeah, that's what I found. I've had my best professional moments in the games that don't matter.
So I'm looking forward to it.
The real reason we're doing this podcast, because it is Independence Day, you had this idea. We're going to talk about one of the greatest movies ever made, Independence Day.
I think also, this, in the spirit of the movie, this could be our finest hour.
I feel like this is this will be our Picasso moment.
Yeah.
This, you're listening to Picasso paint.
You know that Independence Day won an Oscar?
Did it now?
I didn't know that until I watched the movie again last night. We both did our research last night and rewatched it. And when I was watching it, on the on-demand you know, description of it, it points out the movie won an Oscar for best visual effects.
Wow.
Which I think really speaks a lot to how far visual effects have come, because if that won the Oscar for
best visual effects. No lie, I was actually thinking last night as I was watching, I was like, man, this seems dated. Like, this seems really dated.
It does. It really feels it. I mean, and the special effects are mostly like somebody running with fire in the background.
Yeah.
You know, or people running down the street with a spaceship like slowly coming in over their heads. You know, there's not a ton of big visual effects from that standpoint, the crazy explosions and that sort of thing. To me, it didn't seem like it.
It was nominated for Best Sound, which I don't really understand that award.
What does that mean?
I feel like that's sound? The most improved player award, or maybe all rookie.
It lost Best Sound, apparently.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting.
I want to see what it was up against. It was up against Dragonheart and Twister for best effects.
Well, Twister was pretty awesome.
I actually feel like the effects in Twister are better.
I think so too, maybe, yeah.
I will say this. I think Twister lost out because in the preview, in the trailer, they had that tire come through the window of a truck, and that's not in the movie at all.
Yeah, that's, I remember that.
That's probably the reason that it lost.
I don't remember Dragonheart.
I don't remember Dragonheart either, but I do know that they lost Best Sound to the English Patient, which I guess it had sound in there, and The Rock was nominated.
Huh.
So for Best Sound. Twister also nominated for Best Sound. Twister really lost out on awards.
Twister kind of cashed in though. Like, I didn't realize it was that celebrated from a Hollywood standpoint.
Yeah, if you put the over under on 0.5 Academy Awards that Twister was nominated for, I would have taken the under.
I probably would have too. although Philip Seymour Hoffman went on to win, did he win an Academy Award for Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor? One of the two.
He won for Capote. I remember that.
Yeah, he was in Twister.
That's right. Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
Bill Paxton's
He was in Titanic, which won a lot of awards.
Right. Helen Hunt, did she win an Academy Award?
She was in As Good As It Gets.
Yeah.
Which was celebrated.
It was celebrated.
By the Academy. I actually just looked up Dragonheart. It's an American fantasy adventure film starring Dennis Quaid. So basically, Dennis Quaid and Randy Quaid were both nominated in the best, whatever that was, visual effects categories.
Helen Hunt... owned the mid to late 90s, because Mad About You was a huge success. Yep. She's in Twister, which is nominated for many Academy Awards, as we just found out. And then she did win Best Actress in As Good As It Gets.
And she was in the Tom Hanks Stranded on the Island movie.
Oh, yeah, she was in Castaway.
Castaway, yeah.
Yeah.
She had a strong run there for a while.
That's your 90s ticker update. for movies. Independence Day came out in 1996, starring Will Smith and Bill Pullman and Jeff Goldblum and Randy Quaid and Robert Loggia. And
it has like a very strong cast, and not just like the major people that you mentioned there. Like, I was thinking, watching it last night, there's a lot of really good cameos in that movie. Howard Hesseman has a cameo as one of the White House advisors. I mean, really, Harry Connick was sort of a cameo role in the movie.
I want to talk about Harry Connick because I feel like that movie set him up to be a gigantic star. And I know he was very successful, and he's a star, and I know he's more of a musician, but I was blown away by his performance.
Blown away is a strong take on it. I would argue that he has been a pretty large star in terms of his acting career. I mean, you know, musically, that's where he comes from, and that's what he'll probably always do. But he's been on a lot of TV shows and movies and Broadway. You know, that's a guy who could win an EGOT.
Yes.
When you think about it. Because he's done lots of movies. He could win a Tony for TV because he was on, wasn't he on Friends for a while? Will and Grace.
Will and Grace, yeah.
He's done, I think, what movies has he done recently?
I've got his thing. He was apparently in P.S. I Love You, which is an incredibly depressing movie. Have you seen that movie?
No, I have not. He was on American Idol, right?
Yeah, I think he was a judge on American Idol or X Factor, one of those. P.S. I Love You is about a woman who has lost her husband, and he's like knew he was going to die or something, so he set up like all these letters to be delivered in the future, telling her how much, you know, he loves her, and then it's like remembering all this stuff. It's just awful. I mean, it's a good movie, but it's just like don't watch it if you've ever cared about anybody. That's what I would say.
I have not seen it. I don't really intend to see it.
Yeah, you can miss that one. I think the last big movie he was in... Dolphin Tale.
That was a big hit, though.
It was. Before that, I was going to say Hope Floats.
Right.
I guess Iron Giant. Yeah. So, but, I just feel like he's better than his resume. And his resume's good.
Yeah. He's done some underrated movies that were great. Memphis Belle was really good. Little Man Tate I always liked.
Yeah, that's great.
And I've seen him in concert actually as a singer, piano player, and he was great. He's like that classic entertainer, you know, the all-around type. He's like the kind of guy you figure like Michael Bublé wants to be one day.
Right.
You know, he wants to add that stuff to his resume. He just hadn't gotten there yet.
In my notes for this movie, because I watched it last night, as did you, and we both took notes.
By the way, I told Seku we were doing this today, and he said we were both nerds.
Yeah.
But just go ahead.
Yeah, I'm very much on record of agreeing with that. One thing I wondered is that he, at one point, he does as the good reverend says.
Yes.
And he does, like, this reverend...
Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, like this impersonation of Jesse Jackson. I wonder how that started. That was what popped in my head when I watched it last night. It was like, what was that decision? Was that written in? Was that him just ad-libbing? Was that like an inside joke at the time? Because I know, you know, Jesse Jackson was huge in 96, and I just wonder, like, where that came from. Was that his idea? Was that Will Smith's idea?
I kind of felt like maybe they were like, okay, Harry, who can you do an impression of? And he was like, well, I got this Jesse Jackson. And they were like, all right. So do this line in the voice of Jesse Jackson. Yeah. I mean,
he had that, and he was good at Jesse, and he was good at Bette Midler, and Bette Midler just didn't fit.
Really, that line is just like, you know, it's one of about 20 lines in that movie that are, or not really line, that speech. There's these little moments that are built into that movie that are designed to, obviously, act as like turning points in the movie, you know, like they want you to be able to walk out of the movie and say that line. It's like a Schwarzenegger line or a you know, an action movie line where you have like the one thing people remember when they leave, something like that they can put on the poster or that people will quote forever. And I kind of felt like that fell flat a little bit from that standpoint.
Yeah, I was I was blown away by it. I thought it was great.
But yeah.
It starts out, we get, we're at the headquarters, the SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute.
Right.
And he gets, it's like a young scientist guy playing putt-putt by himself. And he's listening to REM's End of the World, which is very, you know, just foretelling. And I thought, like, they could have come up with a better name for the made-up institute. Or maybe it's a real thing, and I just don't know about it.
Good question. It might be a real thing. I'm looking it up right now. It actually is.
Oh, okay. So I just got it on a government list. That's great.
These guys need to change their name. No, it actually is. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence conducts scientific research on life in the universe.
I wonder how much of the budget's going towards that.
I don't know, but they got a great plug from ID4.
They did.
I wonder if the producers from ID4 established SETI after the movie. to kind of like put this out there to be like, hey, so this is a real thing, but maybe it wasn't until the movie was made. I don't know. But that scene reminded me, you know, because the way they find out something's happening is the sound waves, right?
Or right.
They hear something different in the sound waves, which is the same thing that happens in the movie Contact.
Yes.
For that, they get the sound, and that's how they know it. So maybe that's what we need to like. I don't know. To me, that seems backwards. Seems like we would see it before we would hear it.
By the way, I would be so bad at that job because I just would not. I tune white noise out. Like I'm very good at tuning things out, so I would just be. It could have been going on for hours. They would have come rushing into the SETI. They're like, Zach, what are you listening? Like, what's going through the waves? I'd be like, what? I was watching a movie.
Yeah, you got to listen for structure.
I was playing FIFA. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, to me that was I don't know. There's also some line right in around there where they talk about how the I think it's something like the moon is where it's right about at the moon when they realize that it's on its way to Earth.
Yeah, you would have had to have seen that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, we didn't see it till it was at the moon. Like, the moon's not that far away. Like, I would think we have telescopes and stuff that would spot this before it gets to the moon.
And all right,
maybe we didn't in 1996.
That brings up my next note, which is, all right, this mothership is 1/4 the size of the moon.
Right.
I looked it up. The moon is almost 2,200 miles.
Yeah.
So we were looking at something that's 540 miles wide.
Right.
That's, for anyone who's familiar with the layout of California, if you drove from the Mexican border to San Francisco, that's that plus 20 miles.
It's huge is what you're saying.
Yes. The resources it would have taken for this alien race to put together such contraptions...
And it's not like they make clear several times that this race is very much like humankind.
Yes.
You know, and so that means it would be like us building something that big. Right.
And that's always my, with movies like this, and Matt and I have talked about this when talking about like Transformers on the pod, on a basketball podcast, of like when there's so much destruction in the city, all I can think about is, I wonder how much money it's going to take to rebuild the city. Like,
yeah.
How that street is destroyed, you have to repave and all that stuff, rebuild that building. And I just wonder, like, what is the socioeconomic impact on these alien races? No wonder they're going to different planets. There's no way they can live off the one they're at.
Yeah, maybe, well, we don't know their original planet. Maybe the original planet was, like, made of spaceship materials.
Sure, they just picked it apart.
Yeah, they just, like, went outside their back door and picked up, like, a panel, you know, or they were like, hey, here's a window. Maybe that was how they were able to do it. We don't know that's an unanswered question.
Yeah, that's something that they couldn't. I mean, I know you have to cut stuff out of a movie. I would have liked a little background on that.
A little exposition there. Yeah, that's unanswered.
And another thing about these aliens, the scene in the bunker where they're testing the alien, you know, doing experiments. I think they're doing an autopsy on the alien or whatever, and it wakes up and it wraps the guy from Star Trek around his neck and starts speaking for him and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the body structure of that thing. It walks on its toes like a ballerina, which doesn't seem structurally sound. And then it's very top-heavy. I don't believe aliens could move around like that.
Well, there's something else regarding the physiology of these aliens where, you know, when Will Smith is being chased by the aliens in the plane, he's in the plane, the alien's in the spaceship behind him, and they crash in the desert, and Will Smith gets angry, and he walks over, and he says, I don't remember what he says. He has one of those memorable lines.
Welcome to Earth.
Yeah, and he hits the button and pops open the spaceship hatch. And then with one punch, he knocks out the alien.
Yes.
And then the alien stays unconscious for over 3 hours, because by the time he gets to the base, the alien's still knocked out in the back of the thing, in the back of the truck by the time he gets to the base. And they say, how long ago did you find it? And he says, it was about 3 hours. So we have a time frame we can put on there. So either Will Smith has superhuman punching strength, or the aliens are just really kind of weak.
Because I've seen enough episodes of Fresh Prince where he got in a fight, hit somebody, and it didn't matter.
Right.
I don't think he has that kind of strength. Or maybe that's what got him the Ali role all those years later, is he showed like he could throw a punch finally.
That's true. So maybe, I don't know. I think maybe these aliens are, as you said, they walk like ballerinas. We know they have the physiology of humans. They cannot take a punch, as we find out. Maybe they are a lot weaker than we thought going into this thing.
Now, they did have, like, telekinetic power. They could tap into your mind, so...
That's true.
Maybe that's how... Maybe they... I don't know. Maybe they tricked them. Because there's always that... there's a car alarm going off. There's always that... there's that idea, like, oh, if a kid is trapped under something, like, the adrenaline can push a mother to, like, lift up a car or something like that. Maybe their telekinetic powers, like, trick the worker aliens into... like being able to do all this stuff physically.
Yeah,
but they're actually just very weak-minded.
Yeah, maybe that's how they built all that stuff. They just
moved it with their mind.
No, they physically just went to some planet and made all the people on that planet build everything for
them. Oh, I like that.
With their minds. That's an idea.
So there's a scene where people start fleeing the cities in which these things are over.
Yeah, and there's a lot of holes in that scene too.
I had a question for you.
Okay.
You live in New York, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
What would your escape route be?
Well,
because that can't be an easy thing to get out of.
First of all, so, you know, that morning before everyone flees, I believe this is July 2nd we're talking about here. Maybe we should break this down into days.
Okay.
So on July 2nd, that morning, at the White House, you see Bill Pullman and his daughter, and the TV is on, and the signal on the TV is starting to get a little wonky, right?
Yes.
If my cable signal is like that, I would know something's up immediately.
Right.
I mean, when my cable goes down for 5 minutes, I'm on the phone with Time Warner complaining. So I would think, you know, I wouldn't have to wait 7 hours to find out, hey, there's a spaceship messing up our cable signals. I would have been on top of that to begin with. Number two, the New York part. So we see Jeff Goldblum playing chess with his dad. I believe it's in Brooklyn. It's somewhere not on Manhattan because you see the city in the background across the river. And then he gets on his bike and goes into the city. And apparently the cable companies have like their tech support on Central Park South, which doesn't seem like a financially...
This is back before everything was outsourced.
I don't know, but it doesn't seem sustainable or it's a poor decision economically for the cable company. But then, they say, all right, we're going to get out of town. Let's all go, right? So presumably, Goldblum gets on his bicycle and goes back to his dad's place, which looks like it's in, like, Brooklyn or Queens or somewhere. And they get in the car and they drive to D.C. And at that point, he says something like, hey, we have – I wrote it down. Let me find this. He says we have 6 hours before the signal's going to run out and they're going to attack, right? So they figure that out. So it takes them on a normal day, if I went outside right now, got in my car, drove to Washington, D.C. with traffic, you know, you're just going to run into traffic on the Jersey Turnpike, weird places. Getting out of the city, there's traffic. Going into D.C., there'll be traffic. It would probably take about 4 hours if I did that. In the middle of an apocalypse, I have a hard time believing you could do it in less than 6 hours.
Well, especially, all right, there's that scene where he's like, everyone's trying to get out of D.C. We're the only ones trying to get in.
Yeah.
So they have an open road there. But wouldn't that have been the case getting out of New York?
Yes, totally. It would have been brutal getting out of New York. I mean, you could barely get out. They show the street outside the dad's house, and it's all blocked out with cars. Like, imagine trying to get out the turnpike or whatever to get out of New York. There's no way they would make – and the dad's driving. Like, he's not an aggressive driver.
No, at all.
He's not a fast driver.
Right.
So you'd have problems from that standpoint as well, I believe. As far as my escape route, I don't know. I'd probably go jump in the river and swim or something.
Okay.
But I don't know. I'm trying to think about that.
Well, especially it's harder now because you have a family.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But I just – the whole thing about 6 hours. And you see Goldblum. He gets to D.C. They evacuate the White House. They all get out of there. And then they show Harvey Firestein, who is like his coworker at the cable company, stuck in his car like about 2 blocks from the office. So – somehow Harvey Firestein went a couple of blocks in the 6 hours, and Jeff Goldblum went all the way to Washington, D.C. To me,
well, he had to talk to his therapist, right?
Yeah, but he had a cell phone, right?
Oh,
he's
that's
in the
true.
Car
yeah,
on the cell phone. So, and there's some awesome cell phones in this movie, by the
great
way.
Great cell phones, yeah.
Like the old Zach Morris Saved by the Bell,
right?
Cell phones,
and at the time, like I think there are a couple of flip phones. like big flip phones where you only flip like the like bottom third of it, but it was like it was like, oh my god, that's a mover and shaker in Hollywood.
Yeah, those are like government, you know, like innovations that haven't reached the public yet.
I do like that. I don't know if we're on July 2nd or July 3rd, but Will Smith feels a rumble and he wakes him out of his sleep.
That's the second.
That's all right. So we're on the second still, and Vivica Fox says, "Don't worry about it. It's not even a 4.0." I love the idea of a seismologist stripper.
Well, here's the thing to me about that scene is, you know, they go outside. He sees the smaller 15-mile spaceship coming into view, and he's like, "All right, I got to go to the airbase." And she's like, "Oh no, you said you had the 4th of July off."
I know. It's like you said you had it off. The whole damn country's on leave. Yeah. Like, no, everyone has to come back. I also thought, and I don't want to get on a list by saying this, but Bill Pullman at one point says we've got to bring everyone back. Like, we've got to, you know, the military, half the military's on leave, and we've got all these people for the parade and stuff. Like, wouldn't that be the easiest time to do something? Like, if you're trying to attack?
I don't want to get into that.
Right, okay. That crossed my mind.
I would say, though, it's strange that she's so against him going to work where, you know, his job is obviously protecting and being able to be involved in situations exactly like is happening. You know, if you know, my wife knows I cover the NBA for a living, and if I'm, you know, have a day off or a weekend off and LeBron James gets traded to the New York Knicks, I might have to go to work.
Right. You might have to log in for a couple hours.
If something crazy happens, I might have to work a little bit.
Also, she's a hypocrite because she went to work.
That's my bigger point.
Yes.
Yeah. And then about 2 hours later, we see her at work at the world's worst strip club where they have apparently news playing in the background and an American flag on the stage. But yeah, she goes to work. And there's something very hypocritical about that to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I do like that she was just able to judge it right away. Like, she's been through enough earthquakes. Yeah. She's like, no, not even a 4.0. You're fine. Go back to bed. I would say, like, I don't know. The earth's shaking. I think I'm going to wake up and just check on everything, especially because they have a kid running around the house.
Yeah. Well, part of the end of the movie, or the end of July 2nd, I should say, is, you know, she's on the way home or whatever. She's on the highway, and she's in that tunnel.
Yeah.
And the thing, whatever, shoots the laser or whatever it is on the ground, and everything starts collapsing. And everyone's evacuating the tunnel, and somehow she's the only person out of the hundreds of people screaming and running in that tunnel who notices a door to the side of the tunnel. She's able to kick it open, and, you know, Boomer comes in there with her.
Yeah, the dog makes a great dive.
Yeah, the dog makes an awesome... That's a visual effect if I ever saw one. That's an awesome visual effect. But, so I just didn't get how, you know, of all those people running around in that tunnel, she was the only one who spotted the escape route.
Could you have survived in New York if you were in the subway? Like, wouldn't everyone just go down into the subway, or did the beam and the explosion penetrate the subway system?
No, but I think the risk there is that the beam, or whatever it is, let's just call it a beam.
Yeah.
The beam would make all the buildings fall down, which cave-ins or collapsing from that standpoint. Because when she gets out on July 3rd, the tunnel is basically collapsed.
I'd also love to know if there's any, like, potential for radiation poisoning with the aftermath of these destructed cities. Like, I know that they shoot off a nuclear missile
in Houston.
So they sacrifice Houston, which I don't think any NBA writers are sad about that. But they shoot, so they sacrifice Houston, so there's radiation there for the next God knows how many years. But I find it hard to believe that this beam doesn't have any radiation.
Well, we don't know what it is. It's a destructo beam, right? Essentially, it just makes things fall down and collapse and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know exactly... we don't know exactly the chemistry of that beam, and we can't tell if it's... But I guess there could be some residual radiation from, you know, maybe a factory or something else collapses.
Sure.
I have no idea, but I don't think... I think the beam's not about radiation so much as it is about just destructing beam.
Now, I have another question for you.
All right.
You are now grown-up, family man, mature Lang Whitaker. But put yourself in... I'm just going to call her Alex, because that was her name on Saved by the Bell the college years. put yourself in Alex's shoes, who is the stripper friend of Vivica Fox, who goes to the top of the building to like celebrate the arrival of these aliens, and she makes a sign. She's very into this. Like, would you have gone, like, young 20-year-old Lang Whitaker, would he have gone to a rooftop and, like, celebrated at, a rooftop party for these aliens?
I would not have done that. I think she was supposed to represent sort of the fringe, societal fringe. People who maybe don't have the best judgment. And in situations such as that, would, instead of running from the danger, they run to the danger.
Sure. I kind of feel like I would have.
Yeah, you think so?
I think
you would
have
gone up there.
Yeah, I think I wasn't very smart as a 20-year-old.
Would you have made a sign?
I definitely wouldn't have made a sign. That's too much effort.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have, like, there would have had to have been an elevator all the way to the top of that building. Like, we're talking two floors max.
Yeah, I think they show her coming up some stairs.
Yeah, she would, like, yeah. She went, and that was a tall building.
Maybe the elevator went to, like, the next to the top floor.
Yeah, maybe there's, like, a penthouse level or something like that.
Yeah. But yeah, that was really poor judgment on her part. And all those people up on top of that building. But I guess there's going to be that small fraction of people who, in a situation such as that, don't really know how to react.
Right. And so. That's probably just natural selection.
In some ways, yes. Yeah.
So, are we at July 3rd now?
Believe so. Person we haven't mentioned that gets introduced on that first day is Randy Quaid.
Yes. Oh, I had a note about him. So he's in a diner, and locals are teasing him about like being abducted by aliens and all this stuff. Because he says he's been abducted by aliens. Right. He just leaves.
Right.
Without paying, which bothered me. And it made me wonder, like, does he have a tab at this local diner? Do they just, like, did he already pay? Like, I didn't like the fact that he just walked up, or, like, he just got up and walked out of there. That really bothered me.
I think they know where to find him.
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of it.
Crop dusting the wrong fields.
You know what I noticed in that on July 2nd is, and part of this diner plays into it, there's a lot of Coca-Cola mentions.
Yes.
In this movie.
A lot of product placement.
And I hadn't really noticed it until yesterday when I watched it. In the diner, there's a big Coca-Cola sign behind him as he's talking. In Jeff Goldblum's office at the cable company, there's a big Fruitopia machine. You remember Fruitopia?
Right.
Coke's answer to Snapple. There's a big Fruitopia vending machine. Later in the movie, they shoot the Coke can off the off the spaceship. There's a lot of Coca-Cola mentions in there.
He throws a can into the recycling bin. Where he says, "You know how I always wanted to save the world."
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of Coca-Cola mentions, and I wonder if that was like one of the first product placement things that we didn't know it at the time, maybe.
Well, Superman 2 has huge Coca-Cola placement.
Really?
Because he gets like thrown into that giant Coke sign.
Yeah.
At one point, so maybe Coke has just always been in movies and we didn't realize it.
Maybe so. I'm from Atlanta. I'm used to Coke being around all the time. Yeah. So. Anyway.
Is the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta as cool as I remember it as a 12-year-old?
I remember loving it. I've only been once or twice. I haven't been that often. So I remember, the thing everyone remembers is it has the part where you can taste the drinks from around the world.
Right.
The different sodas that taste, like all sorts of crazy flavors and stuff. But that's really all I remember about it. Anyway.
All right, Randy Quaid.
Yeah, the other thing with Randy Quaid is that, I understand he's sort of backed into this career as a crop duster. But why does he, do they still use those planes to do crop dusting? He's like flying one of the Wright brother planes. Like, it's like a biplane, or whatever, the kind where people stand on the wings and stuff.
He's a drunk pilot piloting this Wright brothers contraption, but he recognizes like clearly his nephew or his son. Is it his son? It's his son.
Yeah,
his Miguel? Son on like a Miguel on a moped.
Maybe Miguel comes out and sees him dust that field, although it was the wrong field, right?
Right, it was the wrong field. It was on the other side of town.
Yeah, I don't know. There are some serious questions about Randy Quaid in this movie.
Yeah, and in real life.
Yeah, well, it's a little foreshadowing.
So we're on day three. July 3rd. Cities have been destructed.
Lady Liberty's in the harbor.
I felt like that was an homage to Planet of the Apes.
Could have been. Yeah, very much so looked like it. Although it doesn't really. There's only like one or two shots of this. Like, it's real quick. Yeah. You're supposed to get it right away that this is what's happened. the world has changed, and we now are in a totally different place and time. But right away, on day two here, July 3rd, something came up that kind of caught my attention. Bill Pullman mentions, I should say, the president.
Yes, President Bill Pullman.
Yes, mentions being a fighter pilot in the Gulf War.
Oh.
And so the movie came out in 1996. I assume it's set in 1996.
Right.
But the Gulf War was in 1990.
Yeah.
So
that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, in 6 years, he went from being a pilot in the war to being the president of the United States, which seems like quite a leap for any politician.
I mean, President Obama had a quick rise, but it was still like it took some time.
Yeah, he had to be like a senator first and, you know, work his way up.
Yeah.
But 6 years is pretty remarkable. Maybe he was a war hero. They don't really touch on that. I thought, you know, maybe he kind of rode that.
Is he right up against that floor? Because you have to be 35
yes,
years.
You have to be 35. I looked that up, too. You have to be 35 years old. So, I mean, but that, you could, maybe he was like in his late 20s when he flew in the war. And, you know, maybe he was 29, so maybe he's 35 when he gets into office. He could be a little bit older than that. He could be in his late 30s. It was kind of hard to tell. I will say this. The First Lady appears to be a little bit older than the president.
Quite a bit. No offense to yes. the First Lady, Mary McDonnell. But, yeah. She did. She is quite a bit older.
So, but maybe, you know, maybe. But maybe he was a great war hero. And
how old is his daughter in that movie? She's got to be like 6. So,
Muffin? Or what's her name? Munchkin.
Munchkin. Munchkin.
Yeah. Kind of like Muffin, though.
Yeah. No, Muffin's good, too. she's really young in that. So, like, I think, like, she was either a pre-war or post-war child. But, he really got into life, like, after that war.
Yeah, he turned it around pretty quickly, I would guess.
Good for him.
Or there's always, maybe, we're making excuses for Bill Pullman now, but maybe he was, like, in the National Reserve, or the National Guard, or in the reserves.
Yeah,
He had already started political, and he got pulled back into it. Okay. And had to go serve.
He was the best pilot, and they really needed him to do.
Well, I mean, because later in the movie, he sort of goes right into that leadership role again with the flight squadron or whatever you call it when they go attack the.
There's
the
no plane. Way they would let him fly a plane.
You don't think so?
No, there's no way. Like, there's no like. Oh, our president's really
did you
a hero.
See some of, did you see some of the other people they let fly the plane?
Certainly, they let Randy Quaid fly one. But
one of the guys looks like the. Animal from the Muppets, or no, not the piano player. There's one of the guys who looks like the piano player from the Muppet Band. I mean, some of those guys are like, you know, they're just like, hey, anybody got any flight experience? Let's go.
I do like that because they say, if anyone's a pilot, and Randy Quaid stumbles forward with his flask, and he's like, I'm a pilot. I can fly.
They're letting clearly drunk people fly these planes. So, I mean, if you have Bill Pullman, who's a war hero, you got to use him.
I just feel like Robert Loggia, that's a three-hour conversation at minimum. Not a, what are you doing, sir? Oh, I'm going to fly. Oh, okay. I forgot you were a pilot.
Things are out the window by this point, though. Like, you're not going by the regular rules of presidential and military engagement. You know,
sure.
This is just, you got to go. We don't have time to sit around and talk about this. We got to go. But anyway, we're skipping ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think we were on the morning of July 3rd.
Yes, we've got quick shots of the aftermath.
Right.
President is trying to, regroup. They're trying to figure out a military answer to this attack.
Yeah. I thought that that's when they send, like, the first batch of planes at the spaceship, which includes Will Smith and Harry Connick.
Yes.
And he gives the Jesse Jackson speech. He gives your favorite...
as the good reverend would say.
No, he gives your favorite DM sentence.
Yeah. Kick the tires and light the fires.
Right. Another one of those signature lines.
We found out that Will Smith, one, doesn't get to be a pilot in space. He doesn't get to be an astronaut. And two, that he wanted to marry Vivica.
By the way, that wedding ring... I don't. My wife likes dolphins too. If I pulled that thing out, I don't think
you would
be
not be married right now.
No, I don't think so. I mean, his wedding ring is two dolphins swimming around a diamond or something.
I mean,
like
good
that.
For him for being, you know, a perceptive significant other who knows what she likes. But sure, that's not a good ring.
Put some thought into it, personalize it a little bit, but it's not, not something you want to grow old with, I don't think. But the initial group they send up there to try to engage the spaceship, and we know the spaceship, it's not the main one, it's one of the smaller ones, but we know it's 15 miles across. This initial group, they send looks like 30 planes.
It's 30 fighter jets, max.
Something like that, maybe. And it's a 15-mile spaceship, and they're gonna send 30 fighter jets that have, four bombs each on them. It just seems like a little bit of a wishful thinking. I don't know what they thought was going to happen there, but
it wasn't going to end well. It's tough to watch. If you're pulling for the fighter jets, it's a tough scene to watch because they don't do well.
Yeah.
And a bit of a Star Wars ripoff.
Yeah, true. And that's when that kind of triggers the whole scene where Will Smith ends up knocking out the alien for 3 hours.
Right. So. It's one punch.
Meanwhile, on Air Force One, Judd Hirsch uncovers Area 51.
I find it odd the president would have known about that. He had to have known.
We're getting into other movies here, but in National Treasure, there's a book of secrets that the presidents have.
Yeah.
Tells you all these different things about stuff like that. I kind of feel like something like that may exist. Or at least, I know they say there's plausible deniability is what the excuse they give in the movie for him not knowing about it. But I feel like, he would know about that, or at least know that, and he was in the military. So you would think he'd at least have heard about it.
Right.
Or, have some sort of background on it. But no, it's Jeff Goldblum's dad knows about it.
And I find Jeff Goldblum to be impressively tech savvy. And I know that's his character, but he finds a way to have the internet outside the White House and triangulate a cell phone.
Yep. Sure. He did spend 8 years at MIT, they say at one point, because his dad's upset that he works at the cable company and he spent 8 years at MIT.
Right.
Which I guess is supposed to speak to his lack of ambition in life and why he's not, why his wife or ex-wife is no longer with him. But
I feel like he would have crippling just student loan debt.
Probably. Maybe that's why he went into the private sector.
Sure.
Which could explain some things. but as the Area 51 thing's being discovered, that we also see Vivica Fox and the dog and the kid driving away from the place, and they start kind of picking up survivors.
Right.
I don't know if I'd let her drive.
No.
I was thinking. She might have more value, she's obviously a people person. She might have more value sure. in the back of that truck, kind of just organizing the group back there, talking to everyone, keeping them calm. But she does a good job. I have to say, she does an amazing job of, she's driving along and all of a sudden blended into the rubble is the first lady. And she spots her.
Yeah.
From across a debris-ridden highway. And she pulls over and picks up the first lady, which... I thought that was pretty impressive of her.
No, she's got great vision. It's part of her seismology training.
Yes.
And I do like that she also delivers the "I voted for the other guy" line.
Well, that made me think. So does that mean Bill Pullman's a Republican?
I mean, just speaking in terms of census and voting, track record and voting. Statistics,
Or. The option is that Vivica Fox's character is a Republican.
Or...
Pullman's a Democrat. And it made me think that Pullman might be a Republican because he was so heavy on defense.
Yes.
He's real tight with Loggia.
Right.
Maybe he's a Republican, maybe not. I don't know the answer to that, but it was funny that she voted for the other guy. She could have been talking about the primary as well.
Certainly, yeah.
So, I don't know. Anyway, there's just that one little hint of personal politics that then goes away really quick.
Right.
The other thing about that is, while all that's going on, the Area 51 thing's happening, and it might be my favorite line of the movie. When they get to the Area 51, and they get to, the edge of the laboratory, and they look in, and they see that the, they see all the scientists in there with those white suits on, working, and face masks, and gloves, and everything. And the president's open the door, and the guy's like, "Well, hey, this is a clean area." No static allowed in this. Meanwhile, outside, the entire world's melting down.
Right.
It's like, hey,
No. We've got standards to keep up here.
Yeah. And Pullman says, "Open the door," and the guy opens it up, and they go right in. That was his one of his most presidential moments to me.
Yeah, no, he definitely showed like he's a leader. He's a real doer. Like I feel like he could clean up the country.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that too.
I do like that. Here's something that confused me a little bit. And just like speaking to like the whole resources and the technology of the aliens and everything. So in the 50s, this ship crashed.
Right.
This ship had to have been a part of one of the 15-mile ships at least, right? There's no way that ship makes it through however many light years it would have taken to get to this galaxy and get to Earth. And in, say, let's just say it's like 45 years later.
Okay.
There's been no advancement in the models of these ships.
That's true.
I mean, I know it's not like the car industry, but I just feel like they would have thrown a spoiler on there or some kind of like different color or some kind of sleeker design. It's the exact same ship, and I feel like if they're that advanced in technology, they've just got to be turning these things out with newer features every year.
Maybe that ship that they have designed and they're using is the perfect ship, and they realize it and they're like, we're not going to improve on this.
It could be I guess what's the go-to like plane for our military? It's like the F-18 or something like that. Yeah. I think that's what they fly. I guess maybe that's their F-18.
I don't know. You raise a good point because I don't know the answer to that. And the other thing I thought was maybe they were so consumed with like trying to find new worlds that they didn't have time to like redesign the planes or certainly the ships.
Yeah,
that's a possibility.
Yeah, it's also a possibility.
Pretty soon though, not long after they get to Area 51, Jeff Goldblum is wasted.
Oh, he's drunk.
He gets so mad, and he gets drunk. And then, not that long after, they put him in charge of uploading the virus to the spaceship. So he sobers up pretty quickly, but he has a full bottle of either whiskey or scotch or something, and the next time you see him, it's empty. So I was like, man, he must really metabolize.
He metabolizes and like, well, maybe he was cutting it with, because he had an empty can of Diet Coke at one point.
That's true.
So maybe he's mixing, it's not quite as heavy. But yeah, he like didn't take a nap or anything.
No, as far as we know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. That's something that I thought was interesting.
And so he figures out how to tap into an alien iOS system.
Yeah.
That is just our operating system. That's just it's really impressive. I mean, he really did. Like he is underachieving in life with his
using a Mac.
You're right.
A MacBook or whatever that thing was.
My laptop died a couple weeks ago, and okay. I had to take it in to get fixed, and now it's running very slowly. But it's probably 100 times better than what he was using. There's no way I could tap into alien technology with this.
I can barely like get my phone to sync up with my computer, so that's try to sync up with an alien spaceship that's 50 years old,
right?
At least 50, well, not 50 years old, but from the 1950s,
right?
Well, yeah, I guess it is 50 years old to them, but who knows exactly how old that thing is to begin with. The other thing that happens at the end of July 3rd is Will Smith steals the helicopter and goes and finds Vivica Fox,
right,
and the first lady and that whole group of people. But somehow he finds them, seems like, pretty quickly. Like
the good vision in that relationship is just, she's spotting survivors, he's spotting everybody.
How did he know exactly where to go? How many other stops did he make along the way? Did he leave people did he see other people and stop and be like, hey, oh wait, sorry, get back in the helicopter. You're not who I'm looking for.
And they're like, oh, take me with you. He's like, I don't really have the room. I'm sorry. You've got to survive this wasteland on your own.
I mean, I'm all for suspension of disbelief, and I guess that's what they're asking for there. And I guess numerous other times throughout that movie. But I just think that was pretty hilarious how he immediately finds the people, the one group of people that would have any sort of connection to the group of people he's with.
And I know so. You've said that, you said earlier that, you know, we're in different times with this alien attack and trying to fight back, and so like there's not time to argue with the president about being a fighter pilot. I feel like there's time to argue with him about stealing a helicopter. Like, they need as many resources as they possibly can. He wants to go find his girlfriend?
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, the guy does try to stop him.
Yeah, but, like, offers very little resistance. It was just like, he said, you can't do that. And Will Smith said, yeah, but still, I want to. And he's like, all right, yeah. Fine, go ahead.
I think maybe, I don't know this, but maybe Will Smith was a superior officer.
Oh, yeah, we don't know how high he was ranked.
Because I think the guy calls him sir.
Okay.
But I don't know, that was the one thought I had, was maybe that's how they get out of it. But anyway, that kind of takes us to the end of July 3rd. And then we get to our Independence Day.
And not just our Independence Day, it becomes the world's Independence Day.
That's true.
Spoiler alert. I actually had this thought. All right, he says in his big speech, and we can get to more into the speech in a little bit, but in his big speech he says, this won't just be our Independence Day, it's going to be the world's, essentially. Right. All right. Now we thought maybe he's a Republican. Let's say he's a Democrat.
Okay.
Fox News gets back online 3 days later, right, and he's declaring this the world's Independence Day. How many weeks of coverage would they devote to this? Just slamming him, saying, no, this is an American holiday. You can't give it to the rest of the world.
I don't know. I think at that point, the world would have a pretty good claim to it.
I think they would, but that's not going to stop someone from the 20... Well, I guess the 24-hour news cycle wasn't that heavy yet. We're quite there. Man. Yeah. We're got, like on the cusp of it.
They didn't even have a flat screen in the White House. Did you notice that?
Right.
They had like the old cathode ray TV. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Although they did, like when they showed the cable company office, they had a wall of flat screens. But in the White House, they didn't, and I thought that was kind of funny that the Time Warner Cable was ahead of of the White House in terms of technology.
Yeah, I did start wondering how many groups or states or whatever post this horrible event would try to secede. That's also another thought I had.
I don't know. It might be every man for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Do you still have a government in a country? But Bill Pullman's a guy that is clearly a leader.
Yeah, I think so. He would pull everyone together and assume that role. That, you know, that on when July 4th starts is when Jeff Goldblum uploads that virus to show them how it would work. He has them shoot at a Coke can, which the bullet gets repelled by the force field around the spaceship. Then he uploads a virus to that spaceship, and they shoot it, and it works.
And that upload and inclusion into the system was like 10 seconds.
Well, my question is, then they put a virus into the whatever it is, spaceship, and then they're going to fly it to space? Wouldn't the virus render it?
Hey, we need you to drive this package to Mexico, but we're going to cut your brakes.
Yeah, it seems weird that you would just try to mess around with the virus right before you fly the thing into outer space.
Right.
It's the only way you have to get to outer space and to for your plan to work.
Could they get through the force field by walking?
Well, he puts the can on with his hand.
Yeah, so what? That now I don't understand force fields.
Maybe it only repels things that are going at a certain speed.
Danger or something? Like in the movie Battleship, the alien technology is like judging who is an enemy and who isn't. Maybe it was something similar.
Yeah.
An earlier version of that.
Like moral technology.
I also like the idea. I like the idea that all these movies are connected.
Right.
Like maybe the Bill Pullman not knowing about Roswell or whatever Area 51 led to like, all right, now we have to give every president the Book of Secrets. So then National Treasure happens, and then this alien technology advances to the battleship days. Like I like to think that they're all connected.
I think they kind of are. And so, like it or not, they are connected in some way or another. Something else about the spaceship: when they get in and they decide to go to space in the spaceship, it has seat belts.
It does. Aliens are very into safety.
Well, I didn't know if maybe they, you know, the people in Roswell retrofitted that thing and put seatbelts in there, and just because they knew these, you know, Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum were going to be flying this plane or not. It was odd to me that it had seatbelts. The other thing I thought of that was interesting was when they get to the big mothership in outer space, and the tractor beam pulls them in or whatever, how, you know, it sucks them into the spaceship and docks with them. Is there not someone on that spaceship or a computer or something that would be like, hey guys, this is the plane that's been missing for 50 years. You remember how we lost that one plane on Earth?
Well, this is my question about the models not being updated. Like, I just feel like there would have been some kind of advancement where they like, oh crap, a 56 Cadillac's coming through the doors right now. Like,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Or at least they might have some sort of like, you know, barcode on the thing. Or
right.
It gets scanned when it comes in. Or the guy who's, or the alien who's working the desk might look up and be like, I would think that if you lost a spaceship on Earth and several people, and you knew that this spaceship and not people, alien, and you knew this spaceship and these aliens were missing and probably in the hands of the people, your enemy, the people you're about to attack, you might have some, you know, maybe this is a bit, would be a bigger deal.
Ooh.
And when the spaceship shows up again, the aliens would be like, uh-oh, you know, but no, none of that. It just gets sucked in.
I have a question. So in the lab, they've got the one spaceship, and I think they've got three alien bodies.
Okay.
Was that a three-man crew in that spaceship? And if so, why was only one man that Will Smith knocks out?
These are both good points.
Maybe it's like, all right, this is a research crew, so we've got three people, you know, three aliens.
Yeah, it might have been like an exploratory crew.
Sure, okay, and then you just have the one fighter pilot.
Yeah, by the time you're in the middle of a war, you can't afford that many aliens to be on a crew.
Right.
You got to spread them out a little bit.
Yeah.
You need the body power. That's my guess. I don't know.
That's a good point, though, about the, you know, they dock with the mothership.
Right.
And it's just like, and he knows, like, to close the blinds on the spaceship, and it'll be fine. Like, no one thought that was weird.
Well, the other weird thing about that is that when they're leaving in the spaceship, Will Smith grabs the steering, whatever that thing is, not a wheel.
The steering column.
And pushes one way, and the thing crashes, and he's like, whoops! And he takes the, you know, he had written up, down, left, right on a card or whatever. He turns it upside down, and then immediately he's able to fly it as if this is nothing new. You know, if I'm playing a video game and the controls flip-flop halfway through the game, I don't know that I'd be able to immediately be able to steer the thing to outer space and to dock with the ship and to back out of there and get out of the ship that fast as he does. That was pretty impressive. I think that might speak to Will Smith's ability as a pilot.
Sure, and maybe he should have been an astronaut.
We should also say that when we refer to these people by their names, we actually mean the characters.
Right, yes. Although, I don't know. He's an active guy. He could be a pilot at this point. John Travolta's a pilot.
Yeah.
If I'm using somebody else's laptop and they have the inversion on the trackpad, I'm lost. I can't. I have to change it or I have to use something else. Like, I'm granted I'm not a pilot, but I just feel like that your expectation cannot be overcome that quickly.
Right. Immediately, and the way he flips the card upside down and shoots out of the chute they have set up for the spaceship and starts doing spins in the air. Like, you know, he immediately has it all down.
So, right.
I don't know. Maybe that's something they kind of train into you as pilots.
I wonder if they refueled the ship, because that's got to use a lot of fuel.
I figure there must be some sort of, like, maybe it runs on nuclear power.
There's like a generator.
Must be something in there. Although, yeah, the power comes on when the bigger ship is there. So maybe they, you know, because...
Oh, it's like those, like, wireless battery chargers, maybe?
Yeah, maybe it's something like that runs the thing. I don't know.
I could see that. That makes
sense.
Somehow
it comes right together.
It is alien technology, after all.
True.
They probably figured this out.
It's far, far above and beyond our comprehension set.
If you don't mind, I would like to read Bill Pullman's speech.
I would like to hear this.
Okay. Good morning. Good morning.
Wait. Something happens right before that. It's my favorite thing that happens in every movie.
Okay.
Whenever someone has to give a speech or there's a big moment where there's someone at a microphone, the microphone always feeds back the first time they touch it or the first word they say. Every single time in every movie, they grab the mic and they go, hello. And then they don't do anything differently and it works perfectly.
Yeah, so, yeah, like any megaphone, any microphone, an intercom.
The other guy's talking on the thing, he hands it to Bill Pullman and it immediately feeds back. And then he gives his speech. All right, now.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world, and you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind. That word should have a new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interests. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July, and you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. today we celebrate our Independence Day. That's a great speech on the spot. I can see why he got elected at 35.
We need a shout out to Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich, the writers of this movie.
Oh my god!
Fantastic job.
He rhymes in there. How many rappers are stealing part of that?
I would think somebody should. Yeah, definitely. That sounds like a mixtape, like the start of a mixtape,
right?
You know, and you sample that and then go forward with that. But yeah, I feel like that should be something. That gets more attention.
Yeah, I mean, Wale sampled like Seinfeld scenes, so this has got to be used somewhere.
And he got Julia Louis-Dreyfus to call in on that mixtape, so maybe somebody could get Pullman on the phone.
Yeah,
get him involved with this thing.
Yeah, that's a great speech, though. I would be ready to go fight aliens if he gave me that speech.
Yeah. It was a great speech. The guys get fired up, and then the whole space battle sort of happens. And there was one thing that I noticed in that is that when they get to the end and Randy Quaid is gonna shoot his last missile and then it backfires and he has to, you know, sacrifice himself for the good of the planet, he has two catchphrases.
Yes.
The first time he yells "up yours" as he flies up the thing, or he says "in the words of my generation," and then you think, oh, well, he did it. And then there's another one.
Hello, boys, I'm back.
Yeah. It takes a long time for that, as fast as that plane is flying, the final, 10 seconds, the plane looks like it's going in, super slow motion for some reason. It just almost stops as it goes up in there. I don't know. That was interesting.
I wonder if they just said, oh, we need multiple catchphrases here, and then they just couldn't decide what to cut out, so they just left them both in.
Like I said, there seemed to be a very obvious attempt to have some catchphrases in this movie that are going to hang on and become cultural touchstones, so to speak, and that I think they just threw them all in there. They're like, might as well. You got any other ones? Put them in there, too.
I have to say, I like to think of myself as a very competitive person when it comes to sports and stuff like that. The moment that Bill Pullman fires off the first missile and it hits a force field, I would have been out of there. Not even as him, just as any of the pilots. If I see that thing hit a force field, I would have been, all right, going back to the base.
Well,
I'm out of there.
A lot of them were. And all the people on the ground are like, oh, give it up. Nope. Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I want to try that again.
That was my thought. It was like, all right, look, we just spent the entire evening, all night long, sobering up people and putting them in planes and teaching them how to fly. This guy's been flying a biplane. Hey, go take this jet fighter, and all these different things. And you shoot it, and the first thing doesn't work. I don't know if I would be ready to give up right away. I'd be like, you know what? Hey, we're here.
Might as well. Yeah, I guess smoke them if you got them. Kind of philosophy. Yeah,
one more shot. Might as well. Let's see what happens. The only bad shot's the one you don't take. You might. Let's go for one more.
Okay, I do like the Antoine Walker philosophy of this.
Thank you.
I like that. Okay, I can get into this now.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think I kind of understood Pullman's train of thought there.
And once again, you had 20 pilots?
Yeah.
And they're, it just looked like 100, 200 alien ships?
Yeah.
With better technology, better maneuvering, better weapons?
It seemed like more that second time.
Yeah.
But here's what I don't get. So when the big ship gets nuclear bombed up in space, and then they realize how to take down the smaller ships, the 15-mile ships on the Earth, that those little tiny ships, I don't even know, how are we differentiating between these?
So I guess I would say there's a mothership. We'll call the other ones battleships.
Okay.
And then pilots.
Fighter ships.
Yeah.
Did the fighter ships just crash or something when the motherships go down?
Oh, right, because that was that's what got everything back online, right?
Right. I don't understand. Did they have to shoot down all those little ships, or did they just once you took out the top one, there was a domino effect, and the other ones didn't have the ability to keep going from that standpoint?
How did the aliens know to go to the base? How would they have known?
Yeah, that's a good question.
To go find that base that's out in the middle of nowhere. Because weren't they just going to, the most populated areas and trying to destroy those?
Originally. Also, that showed some poor planning on the aliens' part, because they were there's three coming to the United States. One's in Los Angeles, one's in Washington, D.C., and one's in New York. I was just a little surprised they just stuck to the coasts.
Right. Well, there's one in Houston too.
Later, right? I think.
Oh yeah, I guess that one moves to Houston.
Yeah. I think the one from LA moves to Area 51.
Okay.
But I figured they went there because they knew that the other aliens were there.
Oh, and maybe because that turns on
sort of a reconnaissance thing.
So they can track that, but they can't tell that the 1950s ship goes back into the mothership all of a sudden.
Yeah, that's a great unanswered question there. Like, how do they not, if they knew it was there, how did they not realize it was the one that they sent back to dock at the mothership?
Right.
So I don't know. It was. There's a lot of unanswered questions with this movie, Zach.
There are, and I mean, I'm very surprised we never got a sequel.
Well, supposedly there's one coming. If you look at IMDb, there's a movie coming out in 2016 that's been announced called ID Forever.
Oh.
Part 1 and a Part 2. I don't think it's from the same director and writer. And it says stars Bill Pullman, I guess, is the only one who's been announced as the, I don't know, I guess by that point he'll be former president, Thomas Whitmore. But
you got to get rid of term limits at that point.
That's true. Maybe they just they're like, you're going to be the perpetual president.
Yeah, he's earned it.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. We probably don't have a Congress anymore. We know that they took out NORAD, right?
Took out NORAD. I think the vice president's gone. The cabinet's gone. Yeah.
So maybe he's just in charge then forever.
Did the first lady die?
Yes.
Yeah, she dies. Oh, now he's a bachelor.
That's a good point, though. They don't actually show her.
Yeah, it was just kind of like she said goodbye to her daughter.
And then Pullman goes out in the hall with the daughter, and she goes, is mommy sleeping? And he says, yes. And I guess we're supposed to assume
that
she passed away. But, you know, maybe they, in the sequel, they say that she didn't pass away and she's still around. But to your bigger point there, I am sort of astonished a sequel didn't happen, you know, in the 5 years after that movie came out, because it was popular when it came out. It was a big deal,
right?
And a lot of other movies similar to that happened afterwards, Armageddon and different things like that. You would think they would have kind of tried to strike while the iron was hot and release the sequels as soon as they could.
Oh, I think I've figured out this whole Mac laptop tapping in. I'm on the trivia section on IMDb. And it says the Macintosh laptop that David uses is shown as a PowerBook XXXX, a prototype model with no designation. Mm. This is like a supercomputer.
Yeah.
Before its time.
I wonder if he made that himself.
Maybe he did. Maybe he spent 8 years at MIT. What else was he doing there?
Well, also here, if you look at the trivia section of ID Forever Part 1, it says, soon after the success of the first film, 20th Century Fox paid Dean Devlin a large sum of money to write a script for the sequel. However, after completing writing it, Devlin didn't turn in the script and instead gave the money back to the studio, as he felt the story didn't live up to the first film. It was only approximately 15 years later that Devlin met up with Roland Emmerich to try again, having felt that they had cracked the story for the sequel.
Wow.
I kind of like that. They didn't want to sully the legacy, so to speak. Of that first one.
Oh, this, all right. The movie features, thanks to special effects, 3,978 F-18 Hornets, 52,278 pieces of debris, 3,931 alien attackers. Hmm. Almost 4,000 attackers are taken down by 20 F-18s. I don't believe that there are almost 4,000 F-18s. I counted. There's 26 max.
There's also a section on here called Goofs. I think this podcast could probably fall under.
Right.
Apparently there's several times where the scientists or cast members say things without their mouths actually moving.
Okay. That sounds about right.
Although it's supposed to be July 2nd, Steve's morning newspaper is clearly dated August in the top right corner.
This was almost named Doomsday.
Ah.
Fox wanted it to open on Memorial Day, because they wanted to avoid the competition on July 4th.
I wonder what else came out on July 4th that year.
That's a bold move by them.
What were they trying? Independence Day has a much more positive feeling, you know, than Doomsday.
Doomsday.
Yeah. I don't know. there's a lot of things in this IMDb and under character errors that we probably didn't notice. It says the address on the letter Steve received from NASA reads El Toro, California 50055. That zip code is actually for Collins, Iowa. Anyway, there's we could go all day with these. I love the movie. I think I saw it in the theater when it came out. I'm pretty sure I did. I know I saw Armageddon in the theater, but I'm pretty sure I saw Independence Day in the theater that 1996 when it came out.
Yeah, I definitely saw it. I love the movie as well. I watch it almost every time. Here's what opened, according to Joblo.com, which has theatrical release dates.
I think that may be Joblo.com.
Maybe it's Joblo. That's probably more accurate
pronunciation. Joblo is pretty cool, though.
Its competition on July 3rd was Phenomenon.
Ah, John Travolta.
Yeah. that was the big competition. And then I guess the week before, The Nutty Professor came out.
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. So, and Eddie Murphy was an earner back then.
Yeah, yeah. Travolta was on a hot streak back then too, but I mean, it feels like Independence Day must have had a pretty hefty budget behind it. I don't know what the budget was, but it feels like they must have spent a lot of money on that movie to make it, and you wouldn't be worried about a movie where John Travolta plays an everyman who has weird powers.
Right.
Compared to this.
This claims a budget of $75 million, which back then was crazy.
Yeah. Because I think previous to this movie... The guy, the director, Emmerich, had done... I'm looking right now. Because I know... Well, no, that was like his first big thing executive producing. Because I thought he did... Stargate. So he did Stargate 2 years before that, which was a pretty awesome movie with Kurt Russell.
But,
yeah. And that was sort of a big budget type thing. So I guess that kind of gave him the capital to be able to walk in and be like, hey, I want to go bigger.
Right.
Do Independence Day. After that, he did Godzilla.
Okay, that was not so good.
No, with Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
After that, The Patriot, Mel Gibson.
I like it, but I understand why people think it's awful.
Yeah, I hear that. And then Day After Tomorrow.
That didn't do so well, did it? I just know it was a long time until I watched it, and I ended up watching it on, like, FX or something.
That's the one with... it's similar to
Dennis Quaid,
but it's like the environment's gone wrong.
Yeah, like it's Dennis Quaid and like Jake Gyllenhaal. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I actually saw that in the theater with my mother-in-law. So I can tell you about that.
Okay.
But yeah, he hasn't done a whole lot since then. The most recent thing that he directed was White House Down.
Is that the Channing Tatum one?
Yeah, Jamie Foxx.
I enjoyed that.
I never saw it.
I saw it recently, like a month ago or something like that. And it's a solid. Like they could cut 20 minutes out of it, but it's pretty solid.
I'll check it out now that I know Dean Emmerich was involved. Roland Emmerich was involved.
Now you know it's good. Yeah. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? Were you with this movie at the time, and how happy are you today?
I think it's remained about a 9.5 for me, maybe a 10.
Okay,
up there. What about you?
I would say at the time it was a 10. I would say it dropped down to like an 8.5, and now it's back up to like a 9.5. Yeah. I'm very happy with this movie.
I know we've talked about this before, but you know, I work from home, so I have my TV on in the background a lot of the times, and Independence Day is on a lot of times.
Yes,
and I'll just flip it on, and I probably watch it 50 times, maybe more. I watch it so many times, and I appreciate it very much for what it is.
Yes,
and I'm glad this movie came into my life and your life, and. Hey, happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day. Lang Whitaker, we can read you at the All Ball blog on NBA.com. Follow you on Twitter at Lang Whitaker. And a happy 4th of July to you and to all of our listeners.
And to you.